Hi, welcome to the Charlie Paparelli Show. I am Charlie Paparelli, and I'm so glad that you've chosen to be here. Every Friday, I publish one of these interviews, and if you don't want to miss one, you want to be on the email list, it's just go to paparelli.com and just leave your email, and as a bonus, you'll also get a blog that I post every Tuesday morning. I'm a 25-year angel investor in the Atlanta technology community. And during that time, I have worked with hundreds of entrepreneurs and how to start businesses and how to grow those businesses into valuable companies with high impact. And that's what this is generally all about. But we're going to be doing a little bit of an experiment today. And what I'm calling it is the expert on a topic. So instead of doing an in-depth on my guest, we're really just having a conversation, and today's conversation is actually going to be about a book that had high interest to me and a big impact on me, and I'm still working through it. And the book's name is Die with Zero by a fellow named Bill Perkins. My guest today is Chris Dardeman. Chris is a dear friend and a Christian brother. I met Chris at the Angel Lounge at the Advanced Technology Development Center. And we became fast friends. He's an eighth generation entrepreneur. So this entrepreneur is not new to him. And that's why he was at Angel Lounge as an investor. He was also the co-founder of Brightworth, which is one of the more successful wealth management firms here in the greater Atlanta area with $4.5 billion under management. He shocked me 5 years ago when he told me he was exiting this company that he started at a time when most people say, I'm just going to ride it out because that is a recurring revenue model that it gets the revenue as it comes from a percentage of whatever the wealth that is under management. But he left because he said it was just time to do something different. And he decided he was going to go for his Emory MBA, and that was something he always wanted to do. And of course, Chris plugged right in, and he became an entrepreneur in residence for them. He's also an angel investor. He helps also family offices with their investing into private equity type deals like this. He's married for 32 years, and he has two adult children, and he has one married child, his daughter, who is married to, as he calls this, awesome son-in-law, which I think that's a blessing. I've got a couple of those too. So I think he's the right expert to have this discussion about Die with Zero. So welcome, my friend.
Thank you, Charlie. Great to be with you today.
Yeah. So you're an eighth generation entrepreneur.
Yes, as far back as we
can. How do you even know that?
Because just my mom is a genealogy like guru and she knows every person in our family tree. As far back as we can trace it on both sides of our family, everyone has been an entrepreneur. It's just really kind of amazing.
So who was the last entrepreneur prior to you?
My dad and my mom both, actually.
Your mom and dad, what did they do?
My dad had an engineering business, and my mom was one of the early women CPAs in the South. She had her own accounting practice.
Wow, that's amazing. So I can't imagine what it was like to grow up in your household, you know, what the conversations were around the dinner table.
Well, it was about finding clients, getting clients, doing work. I mean, and my mom helped my dad run his business, you know, from a financial standpoint. Oh,
So. So you talked about it was a life lived on product market fit.
Definitely. And, you know, and again, both of my grandparents had their own business. So it just was growing up in this culture of thinking about business and entrepreneurship. It was such a blessing.
Well, you're special. You know, one of the reasons that I wanted to get together with you on this particular topic is because you are a good thinker. All right. You think deeply and you've got some great experiences, which means you have some wisdom here. This book, Die with Zero, was interesting to me because I'm 68 years old and I've spent my entire life accumulating. You know, you just think, oh, I need to make more. I need to put more away. I need to make sure that everything's safe. And here I am. I read this. I saw this book, Die with Zero, and it was something I was like, I said, I might learn something from that. It sort of struck a nerve for me. So nobody recommended it. I just sort of picked it up. And as I went through it, this big concept of you spend your whole life accumulating, when do you ever get to decumulating? And I said, I don't know how to do that. You know? How do you, if you spend 50 years thinking about, I need to accumulate, I need to hit a number, or, you know, more is better, you know, all that. How do you ever get to the point where you just say, oh, yeah, I need to decumulate now. I need to spend it. And what scared me is it too late, you know? So how did this, so I asked you to read the book and you did. So what are your thoughts?
Well, first, thanks for mentioning the book. Laura and I went to the beach a couple, 3 weeks ago and just, you know, read right through it. It's a pretty easy read.
Yeah.
The book has a lot of great points. I would say the overwhelming amount I agreed with and found helpful. One of the biggest points that the author's making is talking about experiences and how we just, things can't bring happiness is one of the undertones that I sort of got there. But, you know, experiences are things to me that have to tie into your goals and your relationships. So I don't know that experiences in and of themselves create fulfillment, but they can be a tool for fulfillment.
Yeah, but I think what he was saying that the company is it's not just experience. It's not when you, it's funny when you were mentioning that, I was think of H.W. Bush jumping out of a plane at, what was he, 80 or 85?
80, yes.
80 years old, right? And that's one of those experiences. But that is a solo experience. I think what this guy was talking about, when he talks about experiences, is the richness of our relationship and experiencing those, having experiences with those relationships, right?
Yes.
And as opposed to, yeah, I took a, like for me, I said, oh, I had a bucket list item that said, I want to take a motorcycle ride all around the United States. Well, I've always had that on my bucket list from like college. And I've never done it. Okay. Never done it. But now I look at it and I go, that'd be a pretty empty experience to be gone for 2 months by myself on a motorcycle. And then hit all those. I'm like, what's that about?
Yeah.
And I wouldn't want to do it without Kathy.
Right.
It's like going to a movie by yourself, you know? It doesn't make sense.
Maybe you can get some friends to go with you.
Yeah, there. Well, I do have, I do had a guy that, he's called my rabbi of fun, a guy named David Knorr. He said,
I know David. Yeah.
Yeah, he took me, he's an Emory MBA, and he invited me to ride Route 66 with him, but I threw my back out and I missed it. That was 2 years ago. He did it from Chicago all the way to LA.
Wow.
He did it by himself.
Did you ever do Beartooth Parkway by any chance?
The what?
The Beartooth Parkway in Montana.
I've never done that. No, I bet you that's beautiful.
Oh, you would love it.
Yeah. Well, Kathy and I have a trip planned this time, but we want to go to Maine for lobster.
Nice.
So we're going to try that. And I was hoping that there's maybe some time I could run up to Newfoundland. You know, because that would be kind of a pretty ride up and around that area.
Oh, yeah.
But this guy, what he talks about is we need to learn how to live rich and not die rich.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
And, he says the utility of money declines with age. And so that's what kind of stood me up when I read that. I was like, you know, he's right. I had it.
Yes.
If I had the money I have today when I was 20, I'm probably dead by 25, but what I could have done, the energy that I had, the freedom that I had, you know, would have had, it would have been incredible. But now that's what scared me about this whole thing, quite honestly, is like, what am I doing? Where am I going with this? You know? So how do I move from dying rich to living rich?
I think that's a terrific point. And again, getting back to, for me, the idea of achievement and accomplishing your goals is one of the things that creates, if you look at the academic research on what creates fulfillment and happiness in life, much of it comes through goal achievement. And I think tying relationships in with the goals is the magic formula. So to the point, you know, doing these things with family, some of the best successes that I saw over, you know, many years of advising clients was people who would take their kids and grandkids, Charlie, on these amazing trips, you know, an African safari, it could be a week at Disney and staying at one of the properties right there, like the Animal Kingdom or whatever. And they loved that. But I've never heard in a normal family situation someone saying, I wish that my parents had spent less time with us and just given us a little bit more money.
Yeah, but you've done something with your, I saw you send something to me when I asked it. You said, I'm going to send you this bio, use it if you want to or not. One of the things you said is you and Laura wanted Laura is your wife's name, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that you wanted to take your kids to all 50 states before they took off for college?
That was primarily one of my crazy ideas. Laura agreed to go along, thankfully, but yeah. And Charlie, I thought that we had until they, you know, were 12th grade, and our friends that were a little older said, no, you have until the end of their 10th grade year. I said, why? They said SATs, college visits, junior year, senior year, it's parties, and they probably don't want to hang out with you and go on another trip.
That happened to me too, is I did when my first son graduated from college. High school. He's a soccer fanatic. And so we went to the World Cup.
Nice.
In Berlin. And that was an amazing experience together. Okay. Then my second son, my last baby, if you will, he's a baseball guy. And I said, why don't we go visit a lot of the baseball parks, take a few weeks. And he got out and he said, no, I've got other things I want to do. Now he's 28 and he's kicking himself that he didn't do it. But I agree with, you know, life does pass by. You know, it's not like, oh, it's all on my schedule. Now they have schedules and interests, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we were fortunate to finish that up in 2012 with a cruise around the Alaskan Islands and just had a blast. And, you know, sometimes the kids felt like we were dragging them all over the place. But now we have wonderful conversations and memories through a lot of those. One other thing I did is I would take each kid every 2 or 3 years on a trip wherever they wanted to go. At certain ages. And, you know, we just had some amazing experiences that I would not trade for any amount of money, you know, to the book's point of creating these memories.
Yeah, but when you talk about, you said what's important, and you've said this a couple of times now, is you have to have goals. But how did you bring in relationships? How did you say that again?
I guess the point being is not everyone will have the same goals. So if a person doesn't have a family, they may not have kids to take on a trip. So, but they might have friends, they might have, you know, extended family. So I think each person has to adapt this messaging, you know, to their own life, or at least that's what, you know, we tried to do. And so that's really what I was saying is I think there's a goal element to it, and that experiences in and of themselves can bring no more fulfillment than things.
Really? Because that's in direct disagreement with what this guy was saying. And I agree with what he says. Because it's easy to buy things, because it doesn't take a whole lot of time to buy a thing. I mean, I could buy a car. If I say I'm going to dedicate a day and I'm going to buy a car, I will have a new car. All right. It's a different thing to say I'm going to take my kids to the 50 states of the United States. You know?
Yeah. That's, I mean,
a commitment, man.
It was a big one, but it was a blast.
I know it was a blast, but you know, one of the things she says in the book here, which really struck me because it spoke to me and I see it in other people that I hang around with, you know, and that is, he says, once you're in the habit of working for money to live, okay, the thrill of making money exceeds the thrill of actually living, all right? So you get caught up in this competition. You know, I am going to be, first I was an executive, right? And here I am. Well, I just want to move up the ladder and I want more responsibility. I want more money. Okay. And of course the excuse I'm using is I'm doing this all for my wife and kids, whom by the way, I never see, right? Because I'm working all the time, because it's right. A thrill for me to be in that competition.
Yes.
You know, and he uses a comment. He says, don't have a number as your goal. Have experiences as your goal. That would like spun my head around. I never really had that, you know, and I'm worried I really missed out.
Well, good news is you still have some time left, hopefully. and I think, you know, what I would say
to the goal setting point that I was saying to you, you know, when you said, you know, have goals, but have experiences, but as business people who are competitive and who measure our success based on, you know, the deal we got into, the exit that we've had and all that, right. Which just means more money. And oh my God, you were in that deal. Oh, that's great. You made a ton in that deal, right? It's a drug. So we don't know how to get off the train. We don't know how to live life. All we do is keep doing what we're doing. I did make a comment once that said, I did talk to somebody who's a peer of mine. And I said, man, you're like in your mid-70s. Like, why are you still doing what you're doing? And he said, what else would I do? And I was like, oh my God, that's me. And that was one of the reasons I said, you know, I have to stop being this professional angel investor. There's this next stage that God has for me in my life. I wonder what it is, but I have to free myself up enough to do that.
Boy, what you said is great. If you sense God is calling you or any of us to a next phase, it takes faith to go there.
Yeah. Trusting God is a tough thing to do. I've always told people it's one of the difficult things in any kind of career change is to call an end to something as opposed to have it just sort of peter out knowing that it had really ended, right? It's sort of like this product that you had in your business that you find that it really built your business. And then little by little, sales just continue to climb, becomes a cash cow. And you're hoping that you got another product there that's going to kind of take it and kind of run with it. But that's something that worries me personally is to say, I struggled with is I had some advice from a guy. I went to somebody who was he's in his later 70s. And I said, I'm going through my 60s. What should I do? Just keep doing what you're doing. And I said, well, when do I stop? He says, you'll see it'll start to just slow down. I'm like, that's awful. He told me that. And I walked out like, awful. You want something to just like run down? I said, isn't there like, can we call a stop to it for the first time maybe? And then say, I'm going to start something new. I wonder what God wants something bigger for me, I think, than just let it run down and peter out. Are you wrestling with this too?
Well, yes, in different ways, but it takes courage to not be afraid to go explore your future. I'll go ahead and talk about this, and then I want to come back to the comment on experiences, maybe if we have time.
Okay.
I wrote an article a long time ago called Building Bridges to Your Future, and it was basically talking about this concept that I learned from Dan Sullivan, who you may know. He's a he created the entrepreneurial coaching industry. He started a firm called The Strategic Coach, and I was blessed to be in one of his groups for 3 or 4 years, about 20 years ago. But he has a concept he calls your current company and your future company. And he said, you need to always be thinking about what's your next product, your next company, your next version. You can't just get so settled in where you are that you just become complacent. Otherwise, you just will get bored. And so this idea of building bridges to our future, I think, is really helpful to start thinking about what is coming next. And, you know, one of the things I've been blessed with is wonderful mentors for my entire business career. And thank you for sharing your life with me and the others, you know, on that watch you to learn, because few people are willing to share what they're really going through and struggling. But so it's this concept of exploring and going ahead and figuring out some of these things that we might want to do and start trying them. It's almost like doing a micro trial that you might try with a new product or a focus group.
Well, one of the things you did this real time, you know, this is why in the introduction, you shocked me, literally shocked me. I still remember us having lunch. It was the first time we got together and you told me you were leaving Brightworth. And I'm like, you're like, this is the time, this is your 50s. I mean, you should just be just milking it and enjoying it. Okay. And you were like, no. So you called an end to that career as a co-founder of a very successful firm when it was successful. How did you ever get to that?
Well, it was easy, hard, and very hard. The easy part was I was ready to do something else. The hard part was
Give me a look at some of the symptoms that you were experiencing.
Okay, sure. I'm kind of slow sometimes. My wife is the one that really picks up on things. But one day I asked her, I said, how long have I been just not like fully engaged in work, as I had been for, 20 years previous? It was about year 19 or 20. And she said, Chris, you've been sort of starting to check out probably 2 or 3 years ago. And I said, how could you tell? She said, because all of your creative energy was going into things other than your job and that business. And it was, our travel and some of the ministry things that I was involved in and just, things that I was interested in were outside of the core focus. So that part, once I realized that was the easy part. The hard part was letting go.
When she told you that, what was your reaction?
I wish she had told me sooner, but I didn't ask.
Yeah. It is interesting how our wives can see sort of right through us. I mean, you're married 32 years. Friday, I'm going to be married 44 years. Okay.
Nice.
But it is interesting. Kathy can speak directly to me like that. And I have to sit back and go, oh my gosh, they know us well enough that they see because they have a very clear before to compare this after. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I learned early on in marriage that if Laura is willing to say something or to ever disagree, she's probably right 99.9% of the time. Yeah. So I'm better to just say, sure, let's go with whatever you want to do.
Also says something to Laura. She's not careless with what she says to you. You know, she's thought.
Oh, no. She's an amazingly wise and godly person and just what a gift and blessing. So thankful.
So she opened your eyes and it was like, she's right. I'm not using my creativity and my energy really to do Brightworth, So then you go to the hard part.
Yeah. Well, and we were also going through some strategic planning and trying to figure out, because we had private equity investors and we're doing acquisitions and, so we're having these conversations of, you know, among our partners, and how long does everybody want to stay? And, you know, so it sort of dovetailed, and I'm so grateful for, you know, my former partners and friends and just their blessing and help for me getting to go do all the stuff I've been able to do the last
five years. It was hard and then harder, I think is what you said.
Well, it was easy. It was hard. The hard part was,
it was easy.
Really
it was,
letting go of, and then there's a very hard part.
Oh, okay.
But I want to make one last comment for anyone out there who notices that their energy level is starting to shift. That's the red flag, the warning sign to start figuring out what is your next step, what is the bridge to your future you need to start building, and go ahead and get going on it.
You know, so that I wish I would have talked to you sooner, but I came to that conclusion myself.
And it interesting.
Was when, here I am 68, but when I turned 60, I found myself, I did have somebody who's a friend of ours, David Adams. Okay. You know, David, he actually was the founder of Angel Lounge with somebody else. But David said to me, you know, Charlie, you shouldn't be doing angel investing anymore. You know, it's the risk level for it isn't necessary in your life anymore. You should do. And I'm like, well, what else would I do? Right. You know, I was saying that to myself. So I said, I got to keep doing that. That's my identity in the marketplace. I'm this professional angel investor. I do it full time. And so I kept doing it. But here's what happened. I didn't have the interest level that you're talking about. I was a better angel investor at 48 than I was at 62. Hmm. Now, I knew a lot more at 62, but I still was a better investor at 48. Because I was willing to go to all of the networking events. I was willing to meet with whomever. I was active. I was in the community. When I was going to do a deal, I was in the deal. I was the lead guy. I was all this. And I got later, I started to back up. And so then I started investing in my 60s and I started losing money quickly. And the reason was I realized I know what I'm supposed to do, but I'm no longer willing to do the things I'm supposed to do to make sure it was a good investment. And I just got reckless because I didn't know what else I would do, but my creativity wasn't there anymore. And that's when I wrestled with that for 6-7 years before I actually said, yeah, because I didn't have a good guidance. I didn't actually have this conversation with you. I should have connected. All right.
Well, I think it's a process that we all go through, and it's not, you know, that an instant light bulb turns on just one day. So if, you know, if someone hears this story and thinks, oh, Laura said that and I just figured it all out, that is not that's not the rest of the story. You know,
You went to your partners and, you know, how did you actually affect that change?
Well, I mean, it was a long.
I didn't have partners. I could just go, boom, I'm done, right?
Yeah, it was a long process. You know, I mean, I had, you know, several roles in the firm. And the hard part was really the idea of letting go of so many relationships, both people I worked with and especially some of these clients that, I mean, I'm, you know, they're like family. I'd worked with a lot of these for 10, 15, 20 years. And so that was hard. You know, and I still miss some of these people today. Some I still keep in touch with and, you know, whatever, but, you know, a lot of them, you know, life moves on and, you know, you do life with the people that are doing the things you're doing. So the really hard part though, to shift to the third gear was the separation of the who I am from what I do concept. And that took, a good probably a year and a half, 2 years of just a lot of work to separate the person from the company. I had the circles too overlapped, which is probably very normal for founder entrepreneurs. So if I could go back and do it over again, I would try to keep the circles connected, but not fully overlapped.
Okay, tell me what you did. And then,
several things.
See, you're speaking at too high a level for me because I'm relating to this.
Okay.
I wrote an article on this. It's just the
nice
idea of an identity. So if I am not a professional angel investor, then what am I? Okay. And then, of course, I had my Christian buddies come in and say, well, your identity is in Christ. And I say, yeah, but I'm of the world. So the world wants an identity. Okay. And so, and the more importantly, that's external. The internal for me was a real struggle around, if I know what I, when my eyes open in the morning and I know what I am, okay, I am a CPA, I am a business owner, I am name whatever it is, or I'm a professional angel investor, it really does put all my activities in line with easily set priorities, because you're trying to accomplish something under that mission of being that. Well, if you take away a title, the thing, there's no mission in your life. So all the activities you do are great, because there's no filter for them. They're just good activities. And but you're not building anything. And that was really hard for me.
Yeah, I think what I would say is what I learned through a multi-year process of executive coaching and reading books and, you know, time with the Lord, praying, talking with friends, just experimenting with things. What I learned was that who I am is up here. What I do is below that. And so my personhood literally has nothing to do with what I do. What I do, you know, do I need activities? Yes. Do I need friends to do them with? Yes. Do I need a purpose? Yes. My foundational purpose is found for me in my personal relationship with Jesus Christ.
Okay.
Okay. In terms of what I do, you know, on a given day and in a given week, you know, and fortunately, I'm involved in a lot of different companies and a lot of deals. And, you know, so I mentor, I teach one class, co-teach one class at Emory. So I'm involved in a lot of different things. But, you know, this is, and I don't mean this to sound trite, but I came to the point where I feel like I don't need a job title. I don't need, you know, nobody can figure out everything I do, because sometimes I don't even know all that I do. And some weeks it's tiring, but it's amazing and it's fun and it is never boring.
Yeah, yeah. You had a job title up until you chose not to have a job title. When you left while you were at Brightworth, you had a job title. I mean, what was your job title? You were in charge of investment strategy or...
Well, I was the CIO, Chief Investment Officer, for a long time and handed that off. And I was the CEO for a long time.
Okay. So, great. So that's very clear. That's what you did, right? People say, so tell me, Chris, what do you do? Right. And you were like, boom. And it's impressive and it's interesting. So what kind of clients do you have? It begs a lot of questions.
Yeah.
Then you said, I'm not that anymore. And when you and I got together, you said to me, I'm going for my MBA at Emory. I always wanted to do it, and now I'm doing it. So you became, in my mind, a former wealth management company owner, okay, and you became an MBA student. And, by the way, an angel investor. So that's how I parked you, okay?
Yeah, oh, that's fine. No, I mean, I just describe myself now as a—
What did you struggle through at that time?
Oh, yeah, no, it was a lot of identity, trying to figure out, like, you know— Who am I? What do I do? So I think I've settled with this concept of I'm a private investor and I invest in a number of different private operating businesses. And some I'm totally a passive, some I'm active, some I'm, you know, more active than I care to be. So
when Laura talks to you now, you know, is what does she see? Does she see— Like she made a comment. She said, you know, I don't see that your energy is going into Brightworth anymore, right? So you left Brightworth. You know, if I asked her, where's his energy now? What would Laura say?
Well, it's going to be in several things.
Focused, okay.
Yeah. First is going to be finding and getting involved in good investment deals. Okay. That I absolutely love. Finding and, you know, getting into deals and learning about new industries and companies and things that I didn't know. So for me, part of the fun is the research, the exploration, it's the hunt part of it. I love doing that. Love meeting people.
So when you wake up in the morning, you're brushing your teeth, you're thinking about that. As you look at your day, you're thinking about getting into deals or meeting people to get into deal. All that. That's what's on your mind.
That's one of the things. Yeah. I also think about, I really have a just strong passion for this mentoring, helping, encouraging younger entrepreneurs. So I spend a fair amount of time, you know, with that role as well. Most of them I'm actually investing in, but some I'm just, you know, not investing. I'm just investing in them as a person. And in some ways, I actually like helping the entrepreneur more than helping their business. Because I think it's easy to find people who can help you with tactics in your business. It's hard to find people who understand what you're going through and who can actually help coach and encourage you to be the best you that you can be.
I think that that is so true. And that's always been, I've always said I was the entrepreneur's investor, because that's my interest is more the entrepreneur. Than is the business itself, because we know when we get into these very early stage companies, the business is going to change anyway. But to watch multiple that times. Growth of the entrepreneur to me is just incredible. You know, so we've gone from super friendly and 100% hope to I hate you, I never want to see you again. You know, to we get out of that and we become out stronger from that. You know, we mature together. And the entrepreneur matures and gets on to that next thing, you know. Maybe the old man isn't all wet, you know. Maybe he does have some good ideas, you know. But they also told me, you're a little harsh. You're a little too tough on me here, you know. You need to kind of back off. So I had to learn how to be. They made me a better person, as our wives make a better person. You know, good. That's the closest relationship that we have. But how do I go? So one of the things that this guy, going back to the book, one of the things the guy says is, you know, that you have to go from accumulate mentality, you know, to this decumulate mentality. And so it's sort of like saying to me when I read that, I remember I was saying, you know, it's like, I think of Warren Buffett, you know, he spends his entire life and he's 90 now, right? Reading annual reports to find the right investment so that he can have great returns for himself and for his fund investors. And then Bill Gates turns around and says, you know, I'm quitting Microsoft and I'm going to start the Gates Foundation. And I can't remember what it was, where he's going to billionaires and trying to ask them to give away.
The Giving Pledge.
What's that?
The Giving Pledge.
The Giving Pledge. And Warren Buffett, being friends with Bill Gates, I guess they play cards together, and said, oh, that's great. And he like gave him like $35 billion. You know, because the thing I'm good at is making money. I'm not good at giving money away, and I don't really have an interest in doing that. I think it's the right thing to do, but I don't want to spend time on it. So that's what came to mind when this guy says you need to move from accumulate to decumulate. Well, heck, I never practiced that, you know? And then he further said, you know, there's really three periods in our life. There's the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go years. And never having thought about this or put goals in place like you talk about, I look forward from 68 and I go, I don't know, what do I got? 15 years, 10 years? If it's 10 years, then I say, I got three go-go, three slow-go, three no-go, right? Or if it's 15, it's 5, 5, and 5, but it's a very small amount. Now, if I did this when I was 30, I would have 25 years of go-go, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe 10 years of slow-go and 5 years of no-go. So here I am now. I don't know what to do with this. I don't know how to approach it. It sounds right, but I don't know what to do next. You know, have you got any experience in those areas, maybe with other clients or
Yeah,
how do I do this? How do I turn? I can't push my fortune over to Bill Gates, okay, and then just go back to work. I know going back to work isn't the right thing for me, this being it. So
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a great question. And, you know, one of the answer will be found as you, I think it's just digging deep to figure out what's in your heart. Like, what do you really want to accomplish? You know, when you're no longer in this world, what do you want to have accomplished?
Okay. And what kind of answers do you get from people on that one?
Well, I mean, a lot of it.
What's your answer?
What's
your answer?
Well, let me answer the first one first, if you don't mind, and then I'll come to mind. What I used to hear mostly is strong relationships with family. And so that's where this idea of taking family trips and what's the legacy that we're leaving behind, you know, with our children, with the organizations, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit, you know, that we give to or invest in, the people. You know, it really comes down to people, is who are we impacting and what will we leave behind? I think in terms of mine, I don't know that I have the full answer on the whole legacy thing yet, because I've been so focused on the transition to getting to do what I'm doing
why
now.
Why do you call it the legacy thing? Why is it a legacy? Well, why isn't it living now? Why is it what you leave behind? Because what you leave behind to you isn't going to matter because you're dead. Okay.
Yeah, but it matters to the people that you've impacted.
Okay.
And so one of the things, Charlie, that might be interesting for you and for a lot of business people, and I'm not fully like there yet, but I see a future where more people are investing into purpose-based companies that are going to have world-changing purposes, and they are sustainable from a business perspective. And I see less money going into not-for-profits because they often lack the discipline and the rigor that comes from having to be sustainable. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, my son David went to the London School of Economics here recently to get a degree in social entrepreneurship.
Okay.
And I remember when he wrote his paper to get in there, I read it and I go, you know, I don't agree with any of this. he had the same thing. He says, people in the future are going to be investing in companies that, just like you said, are doing good. You know, they're changing the world to make it a better place socially, if you will, and economically, right? So it has to have the sustainability piece. And I balance that against something that one of the Koch brothers I heard in an interview say, we're in business to improve people's lives and make a profit doing it.
Oh, I think that's fantastic. And there are degrees on that spectrum, you know, going
correct,
all the way.
Yeah.
From traditional C corps to the new B corps and all that, and again, I'm telling you, I'm not fully there.
You said you're seeing this.
Oh, absolutely.
There are family offices and things. Where are you seeing this?
There are a number of investment opportunities now in companies. Everything from have no interest in ESG or purpose to ones that are, you know, almost entirely
ESG?
That.
You said ESG.
Environmental, social, and governance. It's
okay.
Or sustainability, excuse me. It's just essentially its values overlay to the purpose of the company. So, but offline, I'll share with you. I mean, there's places you can go and look at lots of these, even at one time, if you're interested. But what I've noticed over the years is that most good investors don't have the same rigor applied to their nonprofit giving that they do to their for-profit investing.
Guilty.
Guilty. We're all guilty of that probably okay. At some point. But the point being is that what I've seen is a number of nonprofits, frankly, are not very good. they're not good users of capital. And, you know, I don't know what to do with that because that bothers me, you know, as a capitalist, but the heart of me loves the mission of what they're trying to do. And so,
so what's their miss when they're not good users of capital? What does that look like?
It's from some of the things I've seen, it's just often using capital in ways that don't create the type of impact that they could create with the same resources. And it could be just a difference of philosophy, or you do see a lot of successful nonprofits. I mean, I was talking with a friend at a party last weekend who told me he had been looking at a lot of nonprofits, and he was shocked to find that one person was funding 70%, over 70% of the annual giving to some very large organizations. I was like, that's not sustainable. Because eventually that person, you know, dies or their foundation runs out of money or whatever. So I'm still learning and growing in this area. So I don't have much to share other than I see
that's
a future.
That you're saying is I'm moving from, my interest is moving from giving money to nonprofits to giving money to these social enterprises, if you will, that are for-profit enterprises.
That can be sustainable, yes.
So you're taking equity stakes in businesses that are going to be, I mean, they're businesses, right? So at some point,
I'm not actively investing, right? Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm not actively investing in these. I'm exploring these.
Oh, you are.
And I'm trying to figure out, you know, for us, like, should some of our charitable giving dollars be redirected toward this? Not because we're I'm trying to make money on it, but because I think they have a chance at being sustainable where what we're doing and some of the stuff over here doesn't.
Would you apply the same if you do that, though? Would you apply the same investor rigor? Or would you kind of say, well, we're just going to price this very high in value so that I'm just getting even a smaller percent? In other words, you all of a sudden you're cutting breaks where you wouldn't in, you know, a normal capitalist sort of deal.
Yeah. The short answer is I don't know that I'm far enough into it to have a super deep conversation on it, okay. But I would love to explore this with you more maybe in the future as I get to it. But
I'd
think
be interested in this. I'd also be interested in talking to my son, David. You know, I think that would be a really interesting conversation as you see what he's doing.
How old is David again, Charlie?
He's 33.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what you said about David, I want to bring back to one of the things that I mentioned and we talked about briefly. But when I mentioned the book, I was about halfway through with Die with Zero. And our daughter, Emily, and my awesome son-in-law, Eric, were with us at the beach and they were working remote. And I just mentioned this concept to her, and I said, Emily, I'm just impressed at your generation, how fearless many of your peers are. I mean, I hear stories every week or two about somebody's kid or nephew just quits their job, moves to Thailand for 6 months, travels all over Asia, and then they come back and they get their same job and they get a raise and a promotion. And this is not the world that you and I grew up in.
Yeah. Who did you work for? Price Waterhouse? Who was it?
Arthur Anderson.
Arthur Anderson. Yeah. It wasn't the world it would have said, if you leave, you're gone, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, don't let the door hit you on the way out or whatever. But so this next generation has a very different perspective on things. And I think they are taking, and here's the book. They are taking the concept of this book and they're trying it out. So, and then Emily, as you know, works for Boston Consulting Group's innovation division called Bright House. And she has studied and consulted on organizational and personal purpose for the last several years. I mean, she's in this all day, every day. So I just randomly casually say, hey, what do you think of this concept? And why is your generation so fearless? She said, well, first, they've been able to learn from the mistakes of your generation. And then the second thing.
By the way, how old is Emily?
Emily is 26.
26. Okay, good.
So she said, we've learned from your generation what not to do. So, but she said the extremes in my generation that have taken the experiences and just gone 150% into them are realizing that the experiences are no more meaningful necessarily than the things were to your generation. I said, wow. So what you're telling
me, I'm not getting that. Tell me it differently.
She said that when experiences become the goal or the idol, the way that many in our generation made things their sole goal or money their sole goal or idol, that they will end up creating a lack of fulfillment if there's not a higher purpose in people's lives. So the idea of...
So interesting. Just to stop, I do have some family members that are that way, that they're not so much on things, but they are 100% on experiences, thinking that that's going to be the answer. That's going to be the fulfillment. And she's saying that her generation will fail as we failed on the materialism.
And that she said, without purpose, and again, this is coming from all the academic and all the research stuff that people have been doing for decades. So it's not, you know, just that, you know, she's 28 and been consulting for a few years. She taught herself to read at like 3 years old. And I mean, she's an unbelievable reader. She reads about 50 books a year. Plus all the stuff she does for work. So, but what she said is, I'm seeing and reading and hearing of our generation is finding the experiences without purpose are no more fulfilling than things without purpose.
So you kind of blew the whole book up here. Okay.
Thank you, Emily.
Thanks, Emily. Yeah, right. Okay. So I don't get it. So if he's saying, look, you need to, what I say here is you need to live rich, not die rich. Okay.
And that's a good goal.
Live rich is the experiences with those that you know and love, right? She's saying even that will be empty. So if, what does live rich then mean to her?
We didn't have time to like unpack all of it because I was only part of the
way. Come on, call her now. Get her on the phone.
Oh, I'm sure she would love to share with you her thoughts.
What do you think they are? What do you see her doing? What do you see her planning? Because it's not what people say, it's what people do, right? So what are you observing from your side about your daughter?
What I observe is they are just super intentional on what they do. And, you know, like they went camping up in North Georgia last weekend, and she's in some very interesting things that are trying to change the world. And so it's finding things that they're passionate about that have purpose and getting involved. You know, as I relate it back,
why is that purposeful though? I'm missing it.
So they went
camping in North Georgia, and you follow that up with saying they're doing things that are on purpose. I look and I go, so they spent time together as a couple, a young couple, and that's a good thing. And it's quiet. But where's this overlay of purpose come into their lives or come into your life?
Feel like they connect with the Lord in the outdoors, which I do as well. So I think that would be one of the things. But the purpose things she's involved with are not camping. It's organizations that are trying to drive change in different areas. And, you know, that she feels like she is in her calling where her gifts and her purpose for her work are in alignment. which many people don't have, for sure.
Can you have a relationship with God?
I think ultimately without a relationship with God, it's hard to have an ultimate purpose. But I do think many people have purpose in their life that is bigger than themselves. It may not be total vertical, but I think there has to be a higher purpose. And we all know people that are very fulfilled and grateful and those things in their life through their relationship with God. And we probably know some that are without a relationship with God. And we know many that are struggling and trying to find meaning and purpose, and they're substituting things and experiences and, you know, it's like, you know, okay, if I had played, you know, 95 of the top 100 golf courses, you know, will my life be complete if I don't get the other five? You know, I mean, yes, it would be.
Will your life be complete because you did 95?
Well, yes. It'd be cool. I haven't counted lately how many I've done, but not near enough.
but is there going to be a fulfillment aspect to that?
I think so. I mean, the 50 state part thing for us was wonderful, you know, because we've checked a big box, but it was not checking the box. It was the experiences along the way and what we did and saw and the people we met. And, you know, I didn't really travel much until after college. I mean, so for them, I wanted them to get a big view of the world. And when they meet people from, you know, wherever, they will know something about what that is. When we see things on television or movies and they go, oh yeah, we've been there. I remember that.
Yeah, but look what you're doing here. When you're talking about traveling with your children, that's one of that was a very big purpose in your life.
Yes, it was.
Right? Family was purpose.
Okay? And it still is.
As the kids leave, if the next purpose is to I'm trying to understand, how does playing the top 100 golf courses fit into purpose? What's that purpose?
Well,
God's,
I think
not it's sitting there going, I created these beautiful courses for you, my son. Okay, go play these courses. Okay.
Oh, Charlie, that reminds me of the story about the two buddies. One of them had terminal cancer. He dies. And, you know, he tells his friend, hey, I want you to come back and tell me how good are the golf courses in heaven. He said, well, if I can, I will. And so his buddy comes back and, you know, like appears to him. He's like, hey, what are you doing here? He said, well, I got permission to come tell you the good news and the bad news. The good news is the golf courses in heaven are unbelievable. But the bad news is you and I are teeing off together tomorrow. So I hope we get to play some amazing golf in heaven, but I think this is where the goal is. What is the goal? If the goal is something that God puts in our heart, that, you know, and we can have goals that are not spiritual that are still amazing. So I think, you know, and do you know who Jerry Bell is by any chance?
No,
he was
I've never
a professor
heard that,
at North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and he wrote just volumes on of research on success and happiness in life. And I'll never forget hearing him. He said the number one highest correlating factor with future happiness and success in life is, did you have a paying job outside the home by age 11?
Wow.
And the reason that that was so significant is because when people learn how to work, they are able to achieve self, you know, they are able to build self-esteem. And one of the things in the book that I like, but also think there's a caution, is when he talks about whatever money you're going to give your family, go ahead and give it, you know, whatever you're going to give to charity, go ahead and give it, or at least earmark it. Concept is really good. But in watching people, I've seen a lot of people give too much money to kids too soon. So you have to balance that with, you know, also don't wait till you're 85 or 90 and then leave them a ton of money when they're 65. What are they going, or 70? What are they going to do with it?
That's interesting. So those are the, that was another thing I wanted to talk about, which comes from the book, is to say there's really three things. If we get into this concept of decumulate, there's only three things that we can do. One is we can spend it. Secondly is we can give it to our kids. And thirdly is we can give it to charities, right? So talk to that a little bit, you know? I mean, it was interesting. I'll tell you, it was interesting when I went to the spend it. Okay, now I got to spend it. I was thinking, okay, first thing you do is you say, we want to spend a lot real quick. You know, you say, well, buy a car. Right? Okay, you'll buy a car. And I look like, but I don't want a car. You know, because I've come to realize over the years, after I get a car, there was this guy, this guy that's down in Orlando named Patrick Morley. I don't know if you ever heard
of him. I know Patrick. Yeah.
Yeah. He made, I read something years ago I thought was great from him. And he said, I was sitting in my house and I'm looking out my back window at the pool. He lives in Orlando. And he said, and I realized we haven't been in that. We pay to have it cleaned every week. But my wife and I hadn't been in that pool for a year and a half. Okay. Cause the kids were gone. Right. And that wasn't part of his life. And he said, somebody, I should sell my house so someone with a family can move in here and really enjoy this pool. And then he said, you know, I found that a pool is good for about a year of enjoyment. He said, a new house is good for like 6 months. And then he said, a new car is about 45 days, you know, and then the enjoyment's gone. It's just a car. Okay. And I did learn that, you know, it's not like you get in every time and you go, oh yeah, this is like the day you got it. Right? It's like, no, nah, I'm just going here. And so if you got a decent car, you know, which we do, it was, it's a good thing. But so I said, okay, so I need to spend money. So where do I spend money? And there wasn't a lot of things that I'm interested in spending money on. So that was a problem. So then I started coming up with this sort of bucket list of things to do, you know, experiences to have. And I worked with Kathy on that and then say, let's apportion them to the go-go years, the slow-go years, and the no-go, right?
And that's great work, Charlie.
Yeah. So that was a way that kind of approached things and still working on that and what's important and where should it go and how should it work. And there, of course, there's not a whole lot in the no-go years, right? You know, the experiences get pretty limited. And you don't know when the no-go is going to come.
That's an excellent point, which ties into his point about health is often the limiting factor for people.
Right. So then I say, okay, then you give money to your kids. And we've been doing that, all right, a little bit. This is at Christmas time. We sort of, at the end of the year, we'll give money to our kids. And, but you have to be careful, like you said, you know, you don't want it to be an amount that's going to change their lifestyles, right? But it is something that you are trying to decumulate and get it out of, your net worth and move it to them so that there's extra money there so they can enjoy their lives, right? They can do things that they might not ordinarily do.
Yes.
And then the giving part has been something that we've been doing too. And that's been, again, you got to be intentional about that. You got to think like, what's my giving strategy? In the past, my giving strategy was pretty simple. If you asked me for money and I knew you and you were really engaged in this nonprofit, I gave you money. That's kind of a weak strategy. It's a lazy strategy, I'll say. Okay. It's not a real top-down strategy. So I've got to get my arms around this thing. So what are your thoughts on those three areas of giving and what have you experienced? Because you've got client experience too.
Yeah. Well, I think first, good work and thank you for sharing what you're doing. I think that's tremendous for people. Again, just I think there's a balance between waiting and giving your kids whatever they're going to get when they're so old they can't use it versus, you know, you also don't want to undermine their self-esteem and their confidence and, you know, that they want to earn their own way. And, you know, one of the greatest gifts as parents we can give our kids is the experience and confidence of them being able to try things. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think one of the things that we all become more afraid of failure as we get older. And that's why people are often unwilling to change or reinvent themselves. We were at a wedding a couple nights ago or a few nights ago, and I was talking with a friend, mid-50s, and just sort of casually, he says, you know, my entire industry has changed, and where I, you know, played and did deals and added value in the value creation change has now been eliminated. And he said, and he's done well. He said, I don't really know what to do next. He said, I don't want to have to reinvent myself. Well, we didn't have time to really unpack that. But I, as I was thinking about it and reflecting later, I thought, what choice do we have but to continue to reinvent ourselves? You know, I don't know what you do if, well, I tell you what happens is when people lack purpose, they age much quicker. You can see this through research and just in all of our, you know, our stories from people. And a friend was telling me this the other day that once his dad quit being involved with the nonprofit he was very engaged with, he said he's aged probably 10 years in the last three or four, just in terms of his mind and so forth. So I think we have to stay engaged and not fear an unknown future. I mean, God is with us and we go.
Why did you say that we're fearful of failing? Why are we fearful of failing after having succeeded all of our lives? Why would that be such a big issue in the reinvention piece? I didn't find it to be that for me.
I think that for the more entrepreneurial wired people, they don't think as much that way. But the people that are more the executive mindset, for instance, when I decided to you know, switch out of wealth management and go pursue more private investing, it was shocking the number and range of people in their 50s who reached out to me, some I knew, some I didn't, who wanted to have coffee, breakfast, lunch, and just talk. And they shared things with me.
Because you became one of them, right?
No. These are people that are still active in their job, their career, CEOs, doctors, lawyers, dentists, accountants. I mean, you name them. People that are bored out of their brains with what they're doing. They're not happy, but they're afraid to change because they don't know what else to do. And maybe financially they can't do it. So I came away with this sense that there's a lot of people in their 50s who would like to do something different, but they don't know how or what to do about it.
Well, I think that that's true. If you've been in a system, let's say you've been a teacher all your life, right? And you've been an academic. So you've been, whether you're a professor in college or whether you're a teacher in high school, whatever it is, you're in a system, and the system, the corporation, you just kind of move along with it. And it takes, and it has very set rules and you play. But so now all of a sudden you come out of that and you are thrust into sort of more of an entrepreneur mindset that you've not practiced your entire life. And that's difficult. For me, the difficulty is not so much in the failing. It's in the effort that it's going to take to do it. So I say, okay, if I decide I'm going to do this thing, is it the right thing for me to pour so much energy into that thing to make it go? And if I don't, then I'm hobbling it, if you will. And it's not going to fail, but it's not going to have like the impact it could possibly have. And that's really disturbing to me. And that's really the tension I have is, am I willing to do what it takes on this towards this reinvention of me? That's my struggle.
And I think that's good. And defining what that is needs to look different as we age. I mean, the sheer fact is our energy level goes down over time. And so we have to define the roles that we choose to pursue or take that are commensurate with the amount of energy and time we're willing to put into it. Mm-hmm. So But I think where the one of the rubs comes in is people want to hold titles or positions, or they want credit for things that they aren't really creating. And so that I think that's where you see rubs in, you know, first one generation in a business and the next generation. And so, you know, there comes a time, if you think about the verses in Ecclesiastes about there's a time for everything, a time to be born, a time to die, and, you know, a time for everything.
That's Ecclesiastes 3, and that's an important point. There's a time to accumulate and there's a time to decumulate too, right? So that's
yes.
What hit me with this.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, to put it in today's context, a time to wear a mask and a time not to wear a mask. You know, I think we have to be honest with ourselves and humble enough to receive input from others as to, you know, what we're doing. Are we in the right role at the right time? And also, I think we can tell if we're honest with ourselves, you know, when things begin to create more stress than they do pleasure or enjoyment, you know, there's like something going on that's telling us this is not the right fit. And so as I've gotten older over time, I've become more aware of energy, like how much energy does it take? Is it worth it? Is being involved with this group of people, is it life-giving and does it give me more energy or does it just, you know, suck the life out of me? And so, you know,
well,
I think
we also move too. There's a transition that goes from us doing it. See, like you made a comment, you said, I'm doing a couple of things. One is I'm interested in new investments, these other smaller company, private equity type deals. But equally so, I'm interested in investing in people, okay? And I think that shows the maturity that you have in your transition, okay? There's this answer of, well, I keep doing what I'm doing because that's what I've always done. But really what we need to do, there is this give back sort of transition that comes into play that says, you know, it's not me doing that's the real power anymore. The real power is in helping the people who are at the stage in their life that they should be doing, right? I'm not the doer guy. Okay, yeah, and that's a tough transition too, you know? So in my case, that would be helping angels, okay, who are newer angels to get into that. And that really was the foundation of this whole Angel Lounge when we got started there, but yeah, I think that's really important is we got to move to the mentoring side and the coaching side and away from the active player side.
In a lot of ways, it makes more sense, you know, and I'm sure like you, I've been blessed with, you know, a handful of people who were ahead in business and in life who have been so generous with their time and just sharing their wisdom and insights and have just always found, if you know what's coming, it's just a lot easier to be prepared for it.
Right. So is this, so help me here on how do I apply this book to my life at this time? This Die with Zero. It hits on so many different things that are so difficult. The general concept is a biblical concept. I think it comes out of one of the Psalms, is that don't give me so much that I don't have to trust you anymore, God, right? And don't give me too little that I have to steal to eat, right? Give me just enough, right? I read something in here where a guy makes a comment. He said, the fellow that wrote this book was an energy trader. Okay, an oil energy trader, right? And he said there was this guy sitting next to him who said, if I get to a net worth of $15 million and I'm still sitting at this desk, I want you to punch me in the face. That was just so great. You know, but it's, you know, this is the difficulty here with this thing is how do we move to the you know, enough is enough. And now I got to move to this next. I'm just really struggling with it. I knew how to live this other life. How do I live this new life? I don't have a real, I don't have a vision for it.
Wow.
And the only people I talk to, they don't either. I don't see anybody doing decumulation. They're more concerned with, will I have enough before I die? I don't want to be broke. And none of them are going to be broke. I read in the book, one third of the people that die have more money after retirement and when they died than when they retired. Okay. When they stopped doing the work, one third. And in most cases, my father-in-law was that way. He was worried. Oh my God. He retired at 53. And he's like, when I just have to have enough when, you know, so I don't go broke before I die. He died with more money than when he retired. All right.
Well, so if you think about, you know, investments,
a failure of, and this guy says, if I die with all that money, then that's unspent experiences.
I agree with the concept. However, what happens if you have accomplished every single thing on your bucket list?
Yeah.
What happens? Now, most people never get there.
You get down on yourself that you're just not a creative enough thinker, or you're not, or you don't enjoy life enough. I don't know what it is. What happens?
Well, my point is, I don't think we should feel guilty if we die with money. But the question is, what's the purpose? I think this gets to the heart. What is the purpose of why we're wanting to continue accumulating? And what I see or have seen often was fear, and that's fear of the future. You had the depression mindset people, you know, that never really know if I'm going to have enough. And, you know, one of the things that I used to always see with clients was that if they, most everyone has a number of the amount of cash that, you know, or money markets they like to keep. And that if they're below that target, it creates stress in their life. If they're above that target, it takes stress off. And so, you know, so I would like to have that conversation with people. And I remember one lady saying, I want $1 million in my bank account all the time. I said, why? She said, because if I lose everything else, I know I won't have to live under a bridge. And that was very important to her. So we did that. But for most people, you know, that's not it. But
so most people with wealth, do they live a life of defense, fear, if you will?
I think, I don't know about most. I think it relates to mindset. You know, I remember a conversation with one guy. He was in his 80s and he's driving like a 20-year-old BMW. And, you know, a 20-year-old BMW has a lot of maintenance and they're maybe not that reliable. And so, you know, he was just moaning about his car. I said, well, why don't you go get a car? He said, oh, a new car. He said, I can't afford it, you know. And the guy was, he was definitely into the eight digits of net worth. And I said, you could go buy three or four cars today and it wouldn't matter a bit to your net worth. And he looked at me like I was crazy. And he's like, yeah, you're right. I just don't believe it. So there's an internal wiring that happens. And I think you hit on it. We get addicted to, and the book Perkins talked about this really well, we get addicted to making money, so that becomes the only gear that we know and we don't shift gears.
Yeah.
And it's like it's an addiction, not, you know, in a classical sense, but just it's what we get used to. It's our normal. And
if you never drove in reverse, it's a really odd feeling. Everything's bad when you do that. Okay. So how do you get to reverse? You see?
Charlie, the good news is you're going to help our generation figure that out and share it. So thank you. But you know, what you're saying is you don't see many role models ahead of you. That's what I'm hearing you say. And frankly, I haven't seen a lot either. I've seen some that have done it much better than others, seen a few train wrecks and probably everything in between. But where I really like the book is the idea of the experiences and the relationships. And what I would add is I think they have to tie into some goal or something you're trying to do. You know, maybe it's just build a stronger heritage and relationship with your grandkids. You know, one of the things my parents did, which was awesome, they had grandparent camp for each grandkid separately every summer. So they would come up and they would spend a week with my mom and dad, and they would design an entire week for each grandkid doing all the things that that kid liked to do. And she would make the food they liked, and they would go to the places they wanted to go. And it was, you know, and I remember my mom just talking about, oh, you know, boy, they just loved this. And I was like, yeah, you picked all the favorite things that they love to do and all their favorite foods. And, you know, and so it was, they were so generous to do that. But for them, that was important to build that relationship. Now, that wasn't taking them on an African safari or whatever, but it still was meaningful. So, you know, not every experience requires a ton of money. I mean, some do. And, you know, if you want to go take a safari, yeah, it's not cheap, but it's an amazing experience.
You know, you said some things just that in that dialogue you just had there that really hit home for me and tied a lot of this together. Okay. And that is, you talked about know your purpose. Okay. And God has clearly given us purpose. Okay. I had somebody call me and he said, after reading my blog on this whole thing, he says, you want the one word that you need to tell people, okay, if they ask you what you do? He said, you are an impact player for Jesus. That's what he told me. And I was like, yeah. And I can't get it out of my head now. That's what I do, okay? I'm an impact player for Jesus, okay? So I have this higher purpose, this purpose that can then translate into some pretty interesting goals, which is the second piece that you mentioned, that you have to have these goals, okay, and they have to integrate with people, my relationships. And then the last piece, which I have, I don't think I have the second piece. I think I have the first piece. I don't think I have the second piece yet, the goals, but I know based on our conversation need to get there. And the third piece is where I have failed bitterly. Okay, and that is to put a plan together and execute the plan, right? So in light of take those three things off the table, what do you do? What does Charlie do? Charlie just keeps doing what Charlie's been doing. I'm on automatic.
Yeah, I think okay? You and most everyone.
That is a failure. That's the failure.
Wow. That is good. That is great insight. And I think that actually ties in with what the author's talking about. Charlie,
young man. I think it was, I read that it said in there he was 51 years old. So he hasn't even been to the, what I call the 60s decade, which is transition years. That is a transition that you go through in the 60s. He hadn't been there yet. Be interesting what happens with him.
Well, and he may write he may have a follow-up book, I think purpose translating into goals and then, you know, following and executing the plan is, I mean, I think that's what creates confidence and fulfillment and, you know, it has to link into purpose if our goals are directed and inspired by God.
And I think that the thing that's really exciting and what keeps us younger, okay, or keeps us from aging, I should say that, where we are aging, but keeps us from accelerating that aging that we talked about, is to put ourselves in a position where we can fail. If you live a little on the edge, not like I'm going to fail, I'm going to lose everything, right? But to be on that edge, to expose yourself to say, this could not go right. you know, and if it doesn't, you know, I need to reload. I need to figure out what I'm going to do next. You know, it's not the end of the world failure. In fact, it's pretty exciting to live that way, knowing it can. That's part of motorcycling that I do is, you know, people, the first thing that I tell, if people say, I heard you rode motorcycles. Soon as we talk about it, the first thing they have to tell me is about the guy that, you know, who had both his legs blown off and his arms blown off in this horrible accident and how he's now. Everybody feels duty bound to kind of tell me that. Okay. Everybody. And I just get to the point where it's such a relief. Somebody goes, that must be a lot of fun. I get that so rarely, it sets me back. You know? But I think that motorcycling is that there's something about it that there is if it has a high consequence to failure, right? So you're riding on the edge. You can ride stupid and be that person that has an accident, or you can even ride smart and probably avoid those things, but you never know if you get blindsided by somebody and it happens. But that's an excitement for it. There's a failure aspect to it, an excitement, you know, that keeps you going. So I think that's true in our investing life, you know. It's true in any of our relationships also. There's always a chance of failing, you know. There's always that chance.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you're saying makes so much sense, that what keeps us alive. You know, if all we do is the same thing over and over and over again, and maybe some people like routine, but to me, that would be almost the definition of death, is to do the same thing over and over and over and over again. So
what you did when you started Brightworth, and you did get to the point where you go like, yeah, I know how to do this.
And that's one thing I never probably realized the... You know, and if there's some younger entrepreneurs in here, there'll probably come a day where what you loved at one point, you realize it's time to end it, and it's time to go do something else. And you may not know what that something else is, but it's okay. You can just go figure it out along the way. I mean, think about it. Even early in our careers, we didn't know what we were doing. I mean, we go get a job and we start doing stuff, and you know, and half the time you're just faking it until you make it. And thankfully most people don't know or don't care. And, you know, and I think as we get older, it's like, why can't we just go try new things? And it doesn't have to be a huge risk. It could be a small risk, but you know, I say, let's
interesting go. Interesting is when we are younger, we're surrounded by people who are encouraging us to continue to do and grow. When you get older, you're surrounded by people who are telling you to just stop and just enjoy life, quote, right? And so the people you hang with are so incredibly important to the kind of life that you're going to live in those last years of your life. You know, you could move to Sun City. Is that what it's called?
I believe
the Villages.
Yeah.
The Villages.
The Villages, yeah.
Yeah, right? And yeah, so it's the over 55 crowd and everybody's there to just enjoy life. Okay. You know, and it's, that's a difference. It's just a big party, if you will, you know, and I don't know, it just doesn't seem, it seems to be too self-serving and not to be on sort of God's purpose. Did he put us here to really just, to just sit with the gifts that he's given us? And he's given us an enormous amount of intellect and energy and health and relationships. You know, there's a richness to our lives. And I think that we need to keep on keeping on until we get to maybe the no-go years, you know?
Yeah. And eventually that will come for all of us, but you know, God has given everyone a unique ability, and our gift back to the world is to share that unique ability and the energy and the output that can create to be a blessing for others. You know, and I don't think he intended it this way, but I could see where someone could, you know, take the experiences and it's just all about me. But all the research shows that we are more fulfilled when we do things that help other people. Not just relationships, but actually giving to people that can't help us in return, and, you know, making a difference in our communities. And So I think the greatest thing we can do is share who we are with the world, the gifts God has given us, and, you know, the energy and excitement that that brings. You did mention one other thing I find interesting is that, and I've noticed this, is that I'm frankly more energized by working with younger entrepreneurs than people my own age. And so, you know, if all we're hanging out with are people our own age or older, it's like, okay, you know, there are a few, but, you know, I can only imagine is that the older we get, the harder it is to find people that are interesting and staying engaged and doing the things. One friend, Charlie, that you probably know this person, but he told me they retired, moved to Hilton Head. After about 3 months, he moved back to Atlanta. I said, well, what happened? Didn't you like it? He said, I enjoyed it. He said, I got bored out of my mind. He said, we play golf every day. We go to dinner every night with the same people. We share the same stories, talk about the same thing, and then get up and do it again the next day. He said, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, that happened to me as Kathy and I, we decided, I shouldn't say we, I decided, and then Kathy went along with this. We had this beautiful condo in Sea Pines that was literally on the beach. And we had just really fixed it up like 2 or 3 years ago. And I just said, it was hanging on me. Okay. This condo in that we didn't rent it. Okay. So it was just writing checks every month to support this condo. And every time we were going to go somewhere, we had time to go somewhere. What do you do? Well, we got a condo down in Hilton. Let's just go there. Right. And, I remember I was sitting at my desk the day we were going to close. It was the last day in the condo. It's a beautiful sunny day in Hilton Head. I'm looking at the ocean that's, you know, 200 yards from my balcony and unobstructed view. And Kathy comes out of the bathroom and she's crying. Because she said, you know, I don't understand why we have the money. Why do we have to sell this thing? And at that moment, I looked down and there was this guy who was walking his dog across the grass surface just before you go to the bridge to cross the dune to get on the beach. And that guy, he walks that dog religiously 3 times a day. Okay. And here he is walking past again. And I looked down there and I said to Kathy, and then I started crying. I said, the reason we're selling this condo is because I can't become that guy. Mm-hmm. The timing was perfect. Okay. Now that's not to say I hadn't had regrets along the way, but that was the reason I sold. I just didn't, because it's too easy to say, yeah, we spend 6 months in Hilton Head and then we rent it out and then we spend 6 months. Like, man, I don't want to be that guy. I was 63 years old. I didn't want to be that guy. And so I hear what you're saying. That's a great story to see that guy came back to Atlanta, because that would have been me.
Well, thank Charlie, for those of us who benefit and are blessed by you. Thank you for not being that guy, for sharing your life and your journey, because there are just so few role models that, you know, we have to look to. And what does it mean to, you know, age with wisdom and grace and shift gears? And, you know, what, not being afraid to try new things. I hope you keep doing all the different stuff that you do and change it however, but just the fact that you're communicating and sharing means a lot to me. And I know to so many of your friends and listeners out there.
Well, you've been great. Let's stay friends here and stay involved in each other's lives, because you're in this journey I think you're about 10 years behind me.
Okay. Yep.
But it is interesting. You're on your way to sort of the first grandchildren, and it's going to be a great deal. It's going
to We're be excited whenever the timing's right.
All right.
But no, well, it doesn't have to be anytime soon.
Well, I'll close out the show and then we'll be done here. Man, Chris did a great job here. It is so good to have this conversation with Chris about Die with Zero. The book had such an impact on me. It got me thinking in so many different directions. There's been so many conversations like this with people like Chris, both younger, you know, as to some of my children, and also older, you know, to people like Chris and others who maybe that are even in their mid to late 70s that I've talked to. But the book had me really thinking. So thanks to Bill Perkins and him taking the time to share his life with us. And thanks for you for joining us. And if you don't want to miss an episode, as I said, sign up at paparelli.com. Thank you so much for listening.